Blog Talk Radio. We are not alone. And a very, very good evening, everyone. This is your host, Leslie Mitchell Clark. And I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Mr. Wes Roberts. And this is another edition of Contact. And we are very, very excited this evening because we are welcoming back to Contact one of our favorite guests who hasn't joined us for a little while. I was shocked to see that our guest this evening, Mr. Jason Martell, has not been with us for about 3 years, almost to the day. Isn't that strange, Wes? He was with us in 2012 on February 5th.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember that. And it's almost, like you say, almost to the day, although I think the weather was a heck of a lot better back then. But right, absolutely.
I think the Great Ice Age was a heck of a lot better than what we're going through right now, to tell you the truth. The only advantage of this cold weather is I'm not aging. Every time I go outside, I'm frozen in time. So that's okay. Anyway, we are thrilled this evening to welcome back to the program noted author, lecturer, ancient astronaut theorist, featured commentator on the History Channel's hit show Ancient Aliens, and of course, a speaker at the 2015 Alien Cosmic Expo, which is coming up June 26th, 27th, 28th. And I am talking, of course, about Mr. Jason Martell. And Jason Martell, his research has been featured globally on numerous television and radio networks such as Discovery Channel, the History Channel, the Sci-Fi Channel, the BBC, and many, many others. And not very long ago, Jason garnered worldwide attention by recreating a working model of one of the scientific and archaeological world's most enigmatic objects, the mysterious and anachronistic Baghdad Battery. And we did discuss that quite in depth the last time we visited with Jason. And the Baghdad Battery is residing in the National Museum of Iraq, and the discovery of this 2,000-year-old device suggests that the modern-day battery, was not invented in 1800 by Count Alessandro Volt. Did you know that? Volt's where volts come from?
Yeah, the volts.
But it was actually devised nearly two centuries earlier. So we're going to be talking about all of these things, and of course, we'll talk a little bit about Jason's recent book, Knowledge Apocalypse, and his focus studies on ancient artifacts and the Sumerian culture. So there we go. And I think that he is right here with us this evening. Jason, are you there?
Hello, yes. Hey, thank you so much for having me back on your show.
Well, we are so excited to chat with you. And really, there have been an amazing amount of discoveries and insights in the 3 years that has elapsed since we last chatted. And I absolutely can't wait to hear what you are up to right now, because you're always on the cutting edge, you're always on site. What is perhaps one of the most interesting explorations or research projects that you've been involved with very recently?
Well, you know, from a high level, I'd kind of give you a Twitter answer to say that what we've been doing, you know, in the last few years is utilizing some of the latest technology, using satellite telemetry, drone photography, aerial drone photography, and traveling to several of the locations around the globe that have these, you know, enigmatic structures. Wow, I'm sorry, my tongue's a little...
It's okay.
enigmatic structures around the world that show alignments to astronomical markers that seem to repeat over thousands of years. Aside from the fact that the architecture at a lot of these locations kind of bewilders us in the size of the stones and the scope of the architecture in place. Mm-hmm. So really what I've been doing in the last few years is combining all of the evidence that we have of many of these monuments that align astronomically, and then these repeat over certain thousands of years, and combining that with geographical data, for instance, like at Giza. We know that at one point the Nile of the river, the Nile used to come right up to the shore of the Great Pyramid, so that Pharaoh could literally walk down from the steps of the pyramid and be right at the foot of the Nile.
Yes.
Well, if you look today on Google Maps, as an example, you'll see the Nile is several miles away from the pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
So that's geographical data that we can track changes that are happening within the terrain. So if we combine that also with these alignments that we have in monuments around the world, we're starting to be able to pinpoint a more accurate understanding of when some of these structures were built or why they were pointing to certain time periods in the past to mark them in time and space through these monuments.
Indeed.
That was a little longer than the Twitter answer, but you get it.
I got it. And indeed, we are also now seeing an incredible global picture now of a potential energy grid or a series of power spots or vortices. There are new discoveries all the time. In fact, I was wondering, Wes and I were both wondering if you have as yet been to the to Dr. Osmanagic's discovery to the Bosnian pyramid structure.
No, I haven't focused much on those, as they're still into debate, as they're, you know, really not being studied that closely. And so I don't have a lot of data, Wes, even to confirm whether those are pyramids or not yet. I know they're still kind of in question. But, you know, a lot of these sites that are of interest to us through my team, which I formed, a partner of mine and I have something called Ancient Explorers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be a lot of our focus, at least in 2015, is organizing a small tour of about 20 to 50 people and taking them to some of these locations.
Mm-hmm.
So for myself, I find it very interesting to look at the data again of why there's these astronomical alignments. And for me, it points to kind of where my research has been going the last few years. Is I initially was very much interested in Planet X and Nibiru, and kind of became known for being an advocate of those topics. But a lot of times people would ask about, well, you know, Planet X, if it has this long orbit, or if you don't, you know, we don't ever see it, where is it? It's hard to explain that it could be a planet that orbits billions of miles out, farther than any of the planets we have today.
Yeah.
And then somehow is coming back around. So there must be something else out there beyond just our sun. Is it a second sun, like a brown dwarf, a failed star? And a lot of the latest research is pointing to the fact that when we image other solar systems using the Hubble and various telescopes, most other solar systems around us are binary, meaning they have at least two suns,
mm-hmm.
sometimes up to six, you know. So it's very possible that we are in a binary orbit. And it's a very high-level topic, which I'll try and interweave into the conversation tonight, but it touches on many of the pieces of evidence that we have, not only left in our architecture, where all of these over 30 ancient cultures track the movements of the stars.
Mm-hmm.
Today we call it the 12 constellations of the zodiac, but they used it as a celestial clock tracking time in a very large cycle that we're just now starting to understand.
Indeed, and even in the work of Sitchin, of course, he very clearly translated extensive materials about how these astrological signs, you know, had their origins with the Anunnaki culture, and that certain things couldn't even occur until they transmuted from the reign, if you will, of one constellation to the other, which of course was part of the big frustration that went on with between Marduk and Enki and the power struggles that went on according to the Sitchin material. So it really does make a lot of sense, and it must be highly controversial what you're saying, talking about us being in a binary system, but it makes an awful lot of sense compared to, as you say, the information that we have now at our hands. Now, Jason, the pyramidal structures that we find in North America. Now, again, according to Sitchin, he really clearly states that there was the story of Cain and Abel is a sort of a shortened, you know, Cliff's Notes version of what really did happen. But there was a brother against brother situation, and a murder occurred, and the murderer was in fact exiled to North America, and therefore began what we would now think of as Mesoamerican culture. Do you see the correlation, or do you feel that there is a cultural correlation between what we see in the ancient Middle East, in the Shumer region, and what we are finding in Mesoamerica, which of course includes, you know, Belize and all kinds of areas?
So, you know, even though I'm on a show called Ancient Aliens, now going into its eighth season, we're going to breach our 100 episode marker here in season 8.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. I am not necessarily a huge advocate to say that all these structures or megaliths and things around the world are built or influenced by aliens, whether they be Anunnaki or, you know, gods from another planet. It could very well be that. I'm sure that there are some interactions going on. I have no doubt that the Anunnaki do exist, but what I've also come to realize is that all around the world, we have this idea that there was once a culture, like some kind of an Atlantean culture, that through the idea of Atlantis, they existed on one continent, but they were a highly advanced technological civilization, and they, you know, they disappeared or sunk into the ocean, as the myth goes. But it turns out what we're finding out is that around the world, and a lot of the most recent sites being uncovered, like Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, mm-hmm. which they think is like 13,000 years old.
Yes.
But even some of the remote areas, like in Easter Island, what we're seeing is that there's a certain type of being depicted in a lot of these locations. And I'm not necessarily sure that this being is entirely human, mm-hmm. but what I think it could be pointing to is if there was ever an Atlantean civilization, they wouldn't have been on one continent. They would have been a global civilization. And so seeing evidence of their influence around the world in a lot of these sites, what we're seeing is this long, slender being with their hands wrapped at the waist. We see that at Göbekli Tepe. Mm-hmm. We see it in Bata Valley, Indonesia. And yes, in Easter Island, what we thought were the Moai heads, they now know that if they excavated around the head, they're long, slender beings. Their bodies are just buried underground.
Yeah.
But again, their hands are wrapped at the waist. And so yes, to answer your question, even Sumer and many of these other cultures have references or figurines of these very pious and long, slender beings. And so I wonder if they're not referencing some lost ancient civilization that they seem to have influenced all the great ancients that we now revere today, the Mayans, Egyptians, and Toltecs, and Hindus, Aztec. They all seem to have a piece of this lost astronomical data where they use the movements of the heavens to track time much more accurately than we understand today.
Yeah.
And it seemed to allow them to predict the rise and fall of civilization, which kind of comes and goes. And I'll wrap it up with just saying, we've all heard of the terms like the Dark Ages or the Golden Age. These are cyclical patterns that seem to be interwoven into these ancient cultures' understandings of time.
Indeed. And one has to also wonder about the balance of feminine and masculine energies as well. I mean, there are plenty of historical or even mythological accounts of societies that were sophisticated and were in fact matriarchal societies.
Great point.
We talk about the Amazons. There are legends of Amazons in many, many cultures. And again, we're talking about the tall women who were skilled soldiers and rode horseback that we now think maybe came from Scythia, from the Russias, really. But there are all kinds of commonalities going on. And as you say, whether or not we accept alien intervention, whether at the DNA level or at the cultural level, I think that mankind has had more communication done more amazing things than we can possibly get our head around. How else would they have discovered high deposits of cocaine and tobacco in mummies of South America and
Egypt?
I made a mess up there. What I meant to say is, yes, the cocaine and the tobacco were found in the mummies of ancient Egypt. So how does that happen? How does plant life that is known to be completely indigenous to South America end up in vast amounts in the preparation of funereal ritual? So I'm kind of in agreement with you that whether or not it was extraterrestrial intervention, there have been sophisticated, advanced societies that have seeded different locations in the world, and they are deeply involved with the astrological movements. All of them have been, and we're discovering more and more all the time. Now, Jason, tell me a little bit about we mentioned this just in passing. I'm fascinated by your ancient school series. You have apparently a structured training that comes by DVD that you now are offering to individuals.
Well, I started something called Ancient School, and yes, thank you for bringing it up. And it is a DVD series now that essentially just takes people kind of like through someone being at a podium with a huge slide presentation behind them, but it's all digitally remastered into these DVD series so that people can kind of go through a lot of the topics within my research in more depth. But as I mentioned earlier, I partnered with somebody named Amish Shah, and we have a system now through ancientexplorers.com where we're going to be going to a lot of these locations with groups of people. But if you can't go, you can participate through the website as a member, and all of my lessons that I do through Ancient School are included. Plus, we have live broadcasting from a lot of the locations that we're going to be traveling to. So it's kind of a fun way to stay involved, which is ancientexplorers.com.
That is fantastic, and that is sure to be hugely successful. And God knows that's something that I would like to do. Does that sound good to you, Wes? Wouldn't that be really amazing to go off on a little jaunt with Jason to Bobekli Tempe or some amazing location?
Well, actually, it sounds fantastic. And I was looking through the website earlier, and I see that you're building a global community, and the community will actually be the ones to inform your team where to go. Is that right, Jason?
Well, based on their interest of locations, it looks like we're forming our first tour around Chichen Itza and going to a few locations around there. My partner did do a documentary recently where he went to Dwarka, India. There's a sunken city, a huge sunken city, which is recognized by the Indian culture right off the coast of India. And so he did a documentary kind of looking into why they're not, talking more about that and why he can just stroll on the beach and find artifacts and stuff just sitting there in the sand. So it is interesting, yes, very interesting.
There are some really fascinating things. When you're talking about Dwarka, I'm also thinking about that megalithic structure that's been found under the ocean that is just off the coast of Japan that very clearly really mimics, the launching pad-like structures that are...
Yonaguni?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, those are, there are a lot of those underwater sites, which, again, kind of can tap back into a topic I'd like to revisit that you brought up, patriarchal versus matriarchal. There are a lot of these sites that are underwater at this point, and it points to an epoch of time that's much later than what we have on the books. So it's interesting that the ancients, over 30 ancient cultures, used a system of time based on astronomical movements. And somehow we're also aware that there were two suns. There was a famous MIT professor that wrote a book about how over 30 ancient cultures tracked the movements and understood that there were two suns that had an effect on the rise and fall of civilization here on Earth. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a heavy topic to understand that somehow all these ancient cultures all the great ones, again, that we know of today, Egyptian, Hindu, Aztec, Mayan, they all had a system of astronomy that was so advanced and used it for markers in time. But these markers in time went back in time and also forward in time. And today, we call this system of time, from very high level, the precession of the equinox.
Yes.
Which just simply means that every 2,000 years, we move. Our North Star kind of is pointing to a new point in space where we're essentially in a new set of a constellation, just like a Pisces or Aquarius. And so it's very interesting to note that all of these ancient cultures used this system of time to track when they were in their higher ages or when they were in their lower ages, essentially what we call the Dark Ages. Now, different cultures related to this system of time in different ways. The Hindus had a certain set of words to describe these different phases, and the Greeks and Romans had one that we still kind of use today, which was the Iron Age, the Bronze Age, the mm-hmm. Silver Age, and the Golden Age.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a repeating pattern. Then from the Golden Age, you go back into the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, and then back into the Iron. So what I've been noticing, and we'll come back to the patriarchal, matriarchal topic, I'm not skipping it, but what I've been noticing is, you know, when you bring up these things that you're finding cocaine in their blood at 3800 BC, and you look at their amazing ability to do architecture, their amazing understanding of astronomy at that time. However, then we digress and we go into what's now known as the HBO show Game of Thrones, right? We digress and go into the Dark Ages and forget all of that information. All the higher age knowledge they were trying to hold on to at 3800 BC, because that wasn't the Golden Age, but they had so much knowledge that is very comparable to us today and what we're learning about science and magnetism and astronomy. But it's interesting to track that they literally lost that information, went into the Dark Ages, and through Copernicus and Galileo and the Renaissance up till now, we've been relearning what the ancients knew, and we kind of scratch our heads saying, how did they know that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a remembering, it's a recapturing, you know, what we've lost. And I personally feel very optimistic that in this new phase of recapturing our lost technologies, that we're going to be able to get back in touch with Earth energies, free
sure.
Earth energy. And I think probably, Jason, I know you've done some exploration as far as how these Earth energies may have been harnessed by the Great Pyramids. And certainly, I think with some of the technology we have now, we're able to actually perceive energy or heightened this or heightened that in the pyramidal structures. And it's true that the pyramidal structures that I've been to, which I'm sorry to say only is confined to Mexico and the Yucatan, but the pyramids, I feel those pyramids have a palpable energy, which one can perceive without having to have any sort of gizmos.
Well, we'll come back to the energy topic because that is part of my latest research looking into the Ark of the Covenant, why that was taken out of Egypt.
Mm.
And obviously, as you know from Indiana Jones, the Ark of the Covenant is always depicted as this box of lightning and energy and spirits coming out of it. Excuse me. But if we come back to the topic of matriarchal versus patriarchal for a second, I'm going to tie it into that research. You know, it is interesting that a lot of these higher ages where ancient Egypt, you know, ancient India, some of these Hindu texts like the Mahabharata, a lot of these higher ages that were way, way in the past and start to align with a culture that could have been off the map, some ancient culture that we're not aware of. But it is interesting to note that a lot of these first appearances of ancient Egypt, for an example, we see lots of evidence of it being more of a matriarchal focused a civilization, which simply means that man and woman are in harmony versus what we have today, which is a male dominated system of business and society. And from a very high level, anyone hearing this for the first time would probably not understand these topics. There was a great special called The Pyramid Code, done by a friend of mine called Dr. Carmen Bolter, And the pyramid code really touches on this patriarchal versus matriarchal information. And just to give you a taste of how deep this information is for your audience, there's another researcher named Laird Scranton. And, you know, what he was able to do is to explain to us how hieroglyphics are actually used. We look at a bunch of hieroglyphics on an ancient wall and say, oh, it must be a story, and each one of those hieroglyphics is like a letter, like a A, B, E, F, you know, in our alphabet. Well, that's not the case. Each symbol in the Egyptian hieroglyphics, each symbol is like an acronym. Whereas today we have FBI, CIA, FYI, for your information. Now, just by saying that, I don't need to tell you, Central Intelligence Agency, you know what CIA is. But that's exactly what hieroglyphs are. One symbol is an acronym. It has a whole conveyance of a meaning. And so when you're looking at a whole system of hieroglyphics on a wall, you're seeing a very complete set of information being conveyed to the person who can interpret it. So what we have is in the matriarchal past, all the great art, all the harmony and balance and things that we would ever aspire to have as a culture seems to have been so lost in the past, thousands and thousands. We're talking 3800 BC is where the Sumer and Egyptians kind of appear. Go back another 4,000 years. It gets very dusty and murky as to where that culture was at that point. But what we're seeing is that in the higher ages of the ancient past, there were these certain pharaohs or gods recognized by the Hindus that literally walked upon the earth and kept balance. I'm sure that they were partly human, and some of them were entirely human. One of them, as an example, his name was Akhenaten. Mm-hmm. And this is some of the latest research that I'll be presenting at the next conference here at Contact in the Desert here in a few months.
Great.
I've been very much studying the teachings and research behind this pharaoh, Akhenaten, who lived in the matriarchal time period, not a patriarchal, mm-hmm. and was one of the last pharaohs that held on to this time of balance and worshipped what he called the Aten, which is the sun. And so it's a very deep set of information, which I can get into back with the binary stuff, but I'm going to focus on the Ark of the Covenant for a second, because Akhenaten has a very interesting past, because it turns out he was exiled from Egypt, and he took his people with him.
Yes.
However, he also took a large box, which is depicted all over Egypt prior to the Ark of the Covenant and the Hebrew Exodus. So before them leaving with the box, all over Egypt we have depictions and hieroglyphs of a large box, looks just like the Ark of the Covenant, a pole on each side, men carrying it, and it's a large energy device. And the understanding of the Ark of the Covenant was that Akhenaten was possibly using this to power the Great Pyramid. And we say that because mm-hmm. the dimensions of the Ark of the Covenant, the golden box with a pole on each side to carry it, its exact dimensions fit the great sarcophagus in the empty king's chamber.
Indeed.
So it's very possible that, yes, to answer your question about lost energies or harnessing this, it's very possible that the reason why Akhenaten, who could have also been known as Moses,
yes,
left Egypt with his people and took the Ark of the Covenant with him. So, of course, the Pharaoh came back after him saying, give me my battery. And this is a much deeper set of information where we can scientifically now, with our understandings of magnetism and understanding of positive and negative electricity flow, where the priests were literally shielded with a certain type of metal, and there were instructions on how to hold the ark and a whole system of carrying it, which very much sounds like some type of radioactive large energy device mm-hmm. that they revered but respected the instructions on how to use it, and we're now starting to decode that information.
Indeed. And as you're talking about the possibility that the Ark of the Covenant as a power generator of perhaps some type of nuclear power or more sophisticated power than that could have been set right in the king's chamber in the Great Pyramid, if I'm not mistaken, there is very, very strong, solid evidence that within the Great Period, the Great Pyramid, in the King's Chamber, nuclear fission of some sort had taken place. They can tell from the residue. I know there are some scientists who have done an incredible amount of work and actually proven how the chamber itself was in fact a great nuclear resonator.
Well, you know, it is interesting, and Chris Dunn, many other researchers have brought up theories to basically look at the pyramid as a structure that was harnessing, whether it be electromagnetic energy, some type of pulse-generated static buildup energy using water, or some large energy discharge from some type of device that literally it's built to just kind of diffuse the energy towards certain specific locations.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a world energy grid or not, I do find it interesting that a lot of these sites seem to have had what we can apply is a term called vitrification.
Yes.
And so what we see is a glassing effect where a lot of these sites where there's no mortar and megalithic stones have been placed perfectly together, mortarless, and they stand in the, you know, the test of time. And so we can't understand how they were able to mold the stones like at Machu Picchu or Sacsayhuaman, Teotihuacan, you know, there's a lot of these sites, Pumapunku even, where the cuts in the stone, in the diorite and granite, they're so mathematically perfect. There's just no way they can do it other than explaining it like this, a process called vitrification.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, if you can take a stone, whether it be granite, diorite, what have you, and somehow make it into an almost molten-like state, mm-hmm. not complete lava, but pliable, very hot, it becomes almost like putty. So you can stamp all kinds of designs and cut it here or stack them and cut lines in between them, and then they harden back into stone. The trick, though, the puzzler, is to explain how ancient man was using some type of energy force or a technology that could almost liquefy rock. And to that, we still don't have an answer, but we see the evidence of vitrification, a glassing of the stone after it's been molten and then cooled, all over these ancient sites.
Indeed, and in fact, the mythology that even among the Mesoamericans is that the gods had devices that melted the stones. This is something that is heard, you know, it resonates with the ancient cultures, and it makes perfect sense. Now, do you think, Jason, that in talking about the nature of the Ark of the Covenant for just a few more moments. And by the way, I love the fact that you mentioned the possibility of a Moses Akhenaten connection, which is something that I'm really inclined to accept. But do you think that that the Ark of the Covenant, because it's talked about, of course, as a communication device, etc., do you think that these also could have been portals or moving portals or something not unlike a stargate that could open up space-time?
You know, it very well could be. It's not outside the realm of possibility. You know, I am not looking at it specifically along those lines of research just because I'm not that deep into it. I'm a few steps behind just making the connections to show that Moses and Akhenaten could have been the same person, mm-hmm. and that the Ark actually was being used in that sarcophagus. Now, what it was doing, that's part two. I do think, though, that it is interesting that somehow a lot of the sites around the world, whether it be Machu Picchu or even Egypt, a lot of the sites in South America have these stories where there's literally, in a solid rock, what appears to be a doorway cut into the rock,
mm-hmm.
And they just say the gods emerge from here.
Yeah.
So I would have to say that there is enough evidence to at least raise one's eyebrows in awareness and consider the fact that if there is applied science of some large energy force or something like vortex technology that we don't understand yet, there are a lot of locations where the ancients say the gods appeared here, and the geological setup is something usually that is anomalous, where there's, you know, a huge megalithic stones, you know, that kind of defy explanation. Another example from Sitchin's research would be Baalbek in Lebanon.
Yes,
Baalbek. We have King Gilgamesh, who's a renowned known figure in academic history, recording the fact that while visiting Baalbek, where we have these large megalithic trilithodon stones, huge stones, stacked perfectly. Now there's a city built on it, but at one time it was just a huge platform. Gilgamesh says, "The gods, I heard thunderous booms of lightning and sound, and I saw their craft ascending and descending from this location."
Yeah.
So to me, it sounds like a launching pad, just like Sitchin was theorizing. Mm-hmm. And we see a lot of evidence of them using what appears to be at around 3800 BC, as demystifying to us as it might be, aliens using rocket ship type technology, but that seems to be depicted in various locations from Turkey to Sumer.
Yeah, indeed. I think Wes has a question for you, Jason. Go ahead, Wes.
I just want to harken back to some comments you made on hieroglyphs, because I have a deep interest in this. And just let me put something to you and get your opinion on it. If there was a line of hieroglyphs saying, for instance, Ranset walked down to the Nile, would it be possible that that is actually dual-layered or multiple-layered, as you were hinting at earlier, that it may indeed say that about Ranset, but it could say something much larger?
It could, because if you watch that series, which I, again, highly recommend, it's on Netflix, The Pyramid Code,
mm-hmm.
She touches on a lot of the nuances with people who understand and explain this information, where subtle visuals, whether the man's foot is stepping forward with the left foot or with the right foot. Are they holding up two left hands for some reason rather than a left and a right hand? A lot of these visual cues are giving information that, yes, can have a dual tone, meaning it could be explaining it from the woman's perspective or the man's perspective, or from a divine combination perspective. So there are a lot of layers, and it is a very interesting set of information, the way they're able to put these subtle nuances in the information, whether it be hieroglyphics or statues or of people and such. It's literally that term that a picture is worth a thousand words.
Indeed.
Wow, fascinating.
And speaking of male-female balance, of course, in the art and the depictions of the ancient Sumerian gods, both the men and the women who are, you know, godlike are wearing the same types of things. They're wearing what Sitchin called, you know, communicators. It looks like a kind of a tiara with two little spikes coming out. The men and the women are wearing those. Also, the men and the women are carrying what look to be little purses that allegedly have the waters of life, and I'm not quite sure, you know, what that means, but we do see, as you so keenly pointed out, we do see a balance in the ancient world of male and female energy, which was lost in the sands of ignorance and in the sands of superstition and fear that engulfed our world during the Dark Ages.
Well, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was just breathing in. I was ready for you to say something there.
Well, what's really interesting is that, you know, coming back to this topic of a binary star system, us having possibly two suns, there starts to become a new level of information that I, again, am latching onto and promoting, because it makes sense and resonates with me. I've been fortunate enough to have a business partner named Walter Cruttenden, who runs an organization here in Southern California, Newport Beach area. It's called the Binary Research Institute. And Walter essentially has been working with you know, the same people at NASA and JPL, and just hiring them as freelance scientists to calculate a new model for understanding the precession of the equinox. Up till now, our current sciences, if you were to ask a scientist, UCLA as an example, explain the precession of the equinox, they'd say, well, it's the lunar solar wobble of the Earth having a wobble based on a bulge that's caused, and this causes a retrograde 1 degree every 72 years. We seem to kind of move our position in Earth so that every 2,000 years a new constellation is appearing in our North Star. So it's because of this lunar solar wobble that we have that is causing this effect and elongating our Earth. And there's over 2,000 variables with torque and inertia and explaining all they can to try and explain why that's the case. Okay, well, now there's a new model, and it's based on the idea that we have two suns. But it's a very heavy topic, because let me lay this on you and see if you can understand. The idea of us having a binary system is essentially us saying that our two suns are in orbit around each other, meaning our current sun is not stationary. Oh, it's in orbit around another sun. So if our sun is moving through space, guess what? We're going along for the ride as we orbit the sun. We're literally moving through space, and that's what's changing our view of the solar system and sky around us, at least from the perspective of Earth, is we're literally traveling through space. The kicker of this information is it seems that, again, the ancients, way, way into the past, the holiest ancient records that we have on Earth confirm this science. If we go to the Mahabharata and these ancient Hindu texts, there was literally a seer, a rishi, his name was Sri Yukteswar, a follower of this ancient Hindu information, who wrote a book called The Sacred Science and documented the fact that he was able to just essentially download this from the universe. But many other rishis or seers from ancient Hindu times, we're talking 10,000 years ago, but this is all documented in Hindu Mahabharata texts, which we still have today. They talk about the idea of twin suns and that the orbit of these two suns caused the rise and fall of civilization. So here's the kicker. If you think about the idea that if we're actually in orbit around another sun, all of the energies that we have currently now on Earth respond to sunlight. When you wake up in the morning, as soon as the sunlight hits even plants, right, they lean towards the sun. We all come to life and have energy to wake up out of a state of unconsciousness when there's light and sunlight. It gives us energy. So imagine if there are two suns and the energy of one sun does all of that to us. What if there were two suns in close proximity to each other that somehow magnified everything that we are in our being and allowed us to be in a state of what we would know as the golden age? There seems to be a correlation, guys, between our binary orbit. When our two suns are at their closest point, we're in the golden age. When our two suns are at their farthest point, we are in the dark ages. So there seems to be some correlation with this binary orbit literally having a rise and fall effect on our civilizations here on Earth. And we can track it as a system of time like the ancients have been doing. It's a 24,000-year cycle because we have 12 constellations of the zodiac, and we move through those constellations every 2,000 years. We're in a new position. So we're either going into the Dark Ages, where we've just come out of again, and we're now on the upswing towards the golden age again. Very long way, about 8,000 years until we're there, but still good. But we're on the upswing again. And so it's very interesting how we can even feel how exponentially energy and knowledge has been increasing. And everyone's becoming more aware and interested in shows like Ancient Aliens. And it is an effect on our consciousness that somehow the ancients tracked in a very large 24,000-year cycle. That's hard for us to comprehend in our short lifespan.
Indeed it is. And, you know, what's interesting, Jason, is, of course, what you're talking about with the binary, potentially binary system, is we would have to reevaluate many of these things that we're, many of these phenomena that we're dealing with now, such as global warming. Is it in fact part of the natural process as we travel through the universe, you know, orbiting our sun? And also, I think that something that's very fascinating is that there's only one organ in the human body, or one system in the human body, that is photosensitive, that responds to light, and that is, of course, the pineal gland. And
that we have left of it.
What we have left of it, but in fact, there we are, in fact, being bombarded with an awful lot of photonic energy that's coming from somewhere, like the center of the Milky Way is where they believe it's coming from. But I do think there is a physiological aspect, as you say, to the waking up, that is just as logical as sleeping when it's dark and being active when the light is happening. It's we are sensitive beings and we thrive on light. Otherwise, why would there be so many solar worshiping, monotheistic, if you will, solar worshiping cultures across the globe, across time?
Yep, and it's interesting to understand that even the Egyptians had the ability to know when they were in their higher ages and reflected this information in hieroglyphic information. In Dendera, on the ceiling, on these crypts, there are these huge astronomical reliefs. Anyone can just Google Dendera, Egypt. There are these huge astronomical reliefs where they're showing views of the sky at 8,000 BC. Essentially, if you were looking up from Earth, what constellations would be above you at 8,000 BC? Why are they doing that? Possibly because they're marking when they were in their higher ages. Yeah. As many of these ancient cultures did, it seems that they were using these megalithic monuments and pyramids not only as observatories, but also as markers to say, we recognize the time and point to when we were in our higher age. And that's why the alignments, for instance, at Giza, anyone can use astronomical charting software to say, wow, the Orion constellation is a terrestrial map of Giza at when? 10,500 BC. That's the exact date where Leo is perfectly gazing into the Sphinx, and the Orion constellation is directly above the three pyramids with one slightly offset, just like the Orion constellation.
Yes.
So they were using markers, astronomical markers, to pinpoint to say, what I think to say was, that's when we were in our higher ages. And possibly even in some cases to say, this is when our civilization started or when this sacred information was first learned, you know. But it all points to this larger cycle of time which repeats as we move through these celestial constellations like a grand celestial clock.
Yes.
So if we know this, Jason, history should be our best teacher then, right?
Well, you know, everything tells us, you know, learn from what happened in the past because it's likely to repeat in the future. What I find interesting is an analogy, you know, because we only live 100 years and we're talking about a 24,000-year cycle. And really the key point being that there is this rise and fall of civilizations, that we literally go into the golden age and can literally interpret God and harness our full ability, maybe move things with our mind. Who knows? At that point, yes, interacting with other beings and aliens and other dimensional beings possibly, everything's a possibility. We go into the dark ages and we forget all that and we try and hang on to it. As an analogy, though, if you think about, there's an insect called the mayfly here on Earth.
Yes.
And the poor bug, it only lives 24 hours. Its whole living cycle from birth to death is a maximum of 24 hours. So let's say a mayfly is sitting on a leaf on a cloudy, windless day, and another mayfly comes up and says, you know, I've heard that there's this thing called sunshine or wind, yet I don't see it, and they both die. Does that mean the sun and the wind don't exist? No. In our 100-year lifespan, it's very hard, it seems, for us to comprehend that there is this larger cycle of time that does affect the rise and fall of civilization, and that at one point we are much more aware and we're able to use consciousness far beyond what we understand today. Again, the pyramid code, touches on what you mentioned with the pineal gland, mm-hmm. and explaining that these ancient Egyptians, we think we're cool today with our five senses. Somehow they were aware, I know this is going to sound not believable, but they were aware of 360 senses and used all of the glands in our body, namely the pineal gland, to tap into a much more higher awareness than we can even comprehend right now.
Indeed. That is startling, but actually not all that surprising when you look at it in the long view, in the perspective of how sophisticated these people were, and how now you're speaking about their hieroglyphs and how they were almost, they could almost be interpreted as 3D, 4D, 5D things, perhaps. Perhaps the hieroglyphs are, as you say, are as complex as the various senses that the Egyptians in their high culture had to work with.
Wow, that's an interesting thought. Yeah, that could be.
Now, Jason, do you believe, not to change the subject, but I just also wanted to shout out to our folks out there to remind you that we are talking with Mr. Jason Martell, author, ancient astronaut theorist, new technology researcher, and we're discussing a number of fascinating topics, and Jason is going to be appearing in Canada on June 26th, 27th, 28th at the Alien Cosmic Expo. You can get your tickets right now at aliencosmicexpo.com. Now, Jason, do you believe that the Ark of the Covenant is in existence, intact, in Ethiopia, as the Ethiopian people believe, or do you believe that there are maybe multiple Arks of the Covenant that could be in a variety of sacred spaces?
I don't really know. You know, the Ark of the Covenant's existence, whether it's still in some location or not, I would only analogize like what we see in Indiana Jones. You know, in the original movie, at the end of the movie, what do they do with the Ark of the Covenant? They roll it into a large warehouse with literally hundreds of thousands of boxes to never be deciphered other than through the right chain of command. So I would more than likely guess that if something like that does exist, it's probably under lock and key, and it isn't being used in that purpose anymore. But I could only speculate. What I'd like to at least speculate on in the last 10 minutes that we have, or few minutes that we have here, is a lot of these things with looking at ancient sites here on Earth, it is also interesting to realize that our focus is, our space focus has shifted slightly towards Mars, and it's going to stay there for the next couple of decades. And anyone who's been paying attention, I mean really paying attention in the sense that you log into Mars Global Surveyor and are downloading images, or going to Jet Propulsion Laboratories or Goddard Space Center and getting some of the, you know, access to the archives, which are available to the public. But what we're seeing is a different spectrum of Mars combined with a new level of whistleblowers over the last few years, even currently now happening, where there seems to be a new light being put on ufology. And it's starting with some of the science, for instance, around Mars. Mars has always been depicted as this red planet, uninhabitable, unbreathable on the surface. Well, that's not the case. It turns out that a lot of the imagery we're starting to get directly from our own, what were NASA-funded probes that are still up there, as well as European space agency probes like ESA, the European Space Agency, what we're seeing is a different picture of Mars that is showing literally living plants on Mars, standing water on Mars, methane being detected in the atmosphere, which can only come from degrading plants or animals. It's literally as if Mars is being sculpted or it's finally being shown to us in its true capacity, which is, I have to say, turning out to be very Earth-like. Yeah. And this is, I would think, because I'm saying it myself and I realize that it's shattering information. Now, combining the science of what we have from literally just anyone can log in and see this data. NASA's not reporting it because they can't confirm it, I guess, even though all of the raw data shows that. we're also getting a new level of whistleblowers that have been coming out. There was someone who just came out of the woodwork recently here who claims to have been a sergeant in the U.S. Marine Corps who was stationed on Mars for 17 years.
Yes, Captain K.
Now, whether or not there's 1% of truth in this gentleman's information or the story, the point is there are more and more people like this. There's even literally a video on Netflix called Mirage Men. And anyone can just watch this, and anyone who understands ufology will really kind of scratch their head. The Mirage Men video is literally about someone who's working with the Air Force, is now a sheriff, but is still openly talking and can be verified as to who he was, Richard Doty, as someone who worked with people in ufology to feed them false information and point them in wrong directions when they came too close to classified projects.
Yeah.
It's like there's a new level of transparency coming out that isn't going to be the whole egg cracking open, but what it makes me at least weary of, or at least cautious, is, again, anyone who's studied ufology, there's this idea of a new world order, or things like the MJ-12 documents, or something called Alternative 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
It basically is a big mixing pot of scenarios to say, how can we get everyone to eventually follow a one-world government? And I wonder if the next thing in our future, within the next, who knows, it could be a year or 25 years, but if all of a sudden aliens show up and there's spaceships and the media is covering it and aliens are here, I don't think so. I think it's another coordinated event, like some of the other ones I'm not even going to mention in this show, but it's very possible that something could be coming, whether it's, again, just more information being released, or who knows, maybe within our lifetime there could be some larger staged event, but I'm going to put the emphasis on staged,
mm-hmm,
being the event taking place.
Yes. It seems that the beings that are making contact are doing so in a way that is designed not to frighten us most of the time. And as a hypnotherapist, I work with many individuals who have had abduction experiences, and I'm telling you, the frightening thing with the small grays and that kind of experience is actually incredibly rare, Jason. It's and you would think from the media that it's the kind of experience that everyone has. Even Travis Walton, the film Fire in the Sky, was twisted up and
right,
rewritten to
right,
make it look like that. But what we seem to be seeing, and through the work of Dr. Stephen Greer, is we're seeing a telepathic spiritual kind of contact that is somehow designed not to frighten us. So I have a lot of hope for the future, and you're part of everything wonderful that's happening in our society now, Jason, because you are helping people to wake up. And before we have to say goodbye, it's been way too fast, would you mind just giving us the rundown on your websites? I know you have your official website, and then you have another one. The best way for folks to perhaps join you on some of your wonderful expeditions.
The easiest way is just to go to jasonmartell.com. That's double L, jasonmartell.com. And there I kind of touch on everything that I'm currently dabbling in. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, Ancient Alien Season 8 is coming soon. Unbelievably, we're going to breach 100 episodes.
Yes.
So I'm very grateful that the world is very interested in this information. And I'm very grateful to see the climate changing, where there's a more open acceptance to just exploring these topics. I mean, I again, like I said earlier in the show, even though I'm on Ancient Aliens, I don't necessarily say it's aliens. It could be some lost ancient culture.
Yeah.
Maybe genetically they're not completely human, Homo sapien, but I just think it's not black and white, and we're starting to sample some of the nuances of ancient archaeology. And it starts to really, lend credibility to this idea of the ancient astronaut theory, that beings, whether they be from another planet or from another dimension or some lost civilization or all of the above, somehow have influenced our ancient cultures. And we're just starting to relearn some of this lost data.
Indeed we are. And Jason Martell, I cannot thank you enough for your contribution. You are opening people's minds. I want to tell everyone also to go look at xfacts.com, fascinating website also run by Jason. And we will see you here in the Great White North, Jason Martell, in June. And I'm very pleased because I'm actually going to be introducing you, so I'll get to meet you in person at last. And we can't thank you enough for joining us on Contact. And we hope to have you back again very, very soon.
Thank you so much. Have a great night.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you, Jason. Good night now.
Bye-bye.
And we'd also like to say good night to all of our listeners out there. Again.